Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the U.S. pushes the Iraqi government to be more inclusive. The UAE jails a group for funding Syrian militants. Swift reaction to the sentencing of three journalists in Egypt.
The prosecution of journalists for reporting information that does not coincide with the government of Egypt's narrative flouts the most basic standards of media freedom and represents a blow to democratic progress in Egypt.
Cameroon's military arrests 40 suspected Boko Haram militants. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says forming an inclusive government is the central challenge facing Iraq as he continues consulting with leaders about reshaping the government and countering a Sunni Islamist militant surge. Kerry met today in Erbil with Massoud Barzani, the president of the autonomous Kurdish region in northeastern Iraq, who told the top U.S. diplomat that Iraq is facing a new reality. Barzani said the Kurds are looking for a solution to the crisis. The Kurdish region is next to the area where Sunni Islamist militants, known as ISIL, have seized large chunks of territory in recent weeks, including the city of Mosul. Mr. Kerry met Monday with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, a key Shiite cleric, and the two highest-ranking Sunni lawmakers. Rick Brennan, senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation and a career army officer who spent 5 years in Iraq, tells VOA's Victor Beatty Prime Minister Maliki is part of the problem Iraq faces.
Prime Minister Maliki has been entrenched in his sectarian ways since the moment he took office, and there's been very little that we've been able to do to move him in a direction towards reform. Even when we had 100,000 troops on the ground and we had significant influence in Iraq. So I don't see us being able to make significant influence, especially at a time when if Maliki leaves and you look at the history of what happens to leaders in that country, you leave power, you either go in exile or something happens to you and you go to jail or you end up having some physical harm done to yourself. So Maliki is going to be in no mood to try to make massive reconciliation that would entail him leaving power. The wild card in all this is the fact that al-Maliki's party, State of Law, has earned its reputation on being able to maintain security in Iraq. Obviously, what's occurred in the past couple of weeks has undermined that entire claim that he and he alone and his party alone can maintain security. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the days and weeks ahead. And at what point do the other power brokers in Iraq decide that there's no way that they're able to survive with the Maliki government? And it's important to understand also that there's this huge wave of anti-Maliki sentiment throughout Iraq in the political parties. We used to talk about it as being a anyone but Maliki scenario. But the problem's always been that nobody has been able to find an alternative to Maliki. And this, the latest incident with ISIL, may give them the incentive to look for somebody else.
What does Mr. Kerry mean by, quote, intense and sustained U.S. support?
I'm at a loss for what that means. I mean, if you're giving intense support for the government of Iraq, my guess is what you're saying is that you're supporting the maintenance of the state of Iraq as an entity, but not necessarily the individual Prime Minister Maliki. The problem is that Prime Minister Maliki has the dominant political party in the country. And so to the extent that you support the Shia-led government, and it appears as if you're supporting the Shia-led government, it also looks like you're taking sides against the Sunni, which is going to have regional implications for our friends and allies in the region.
Brennan says the 300 U.S. Special Forces personnel sent to Iraq are tasked with preparing the way for possible airstrikes. He says while such airstrikes are an option under consideration, one errant bomb that kills Sunni civilians will result in a tremendous backlash. He says it's unclear to him how airstrikes will make much of a difference in this crisis. Brennan says one of the unfortunate outcomes of the U.S. withdrawal from Iraq in 2011 was the dismantlement of the U.S. defense intelligence gathering apparatus that would make for a more effective military response. Reconstituting that to an effective level will, he says, be a real challenge. The U.S. is considering Iran's role in the crisis in Iraq, but the Pentagon says it has no plans to enter into military cooperation with the Iranians in any action in Iraq. A top State Department official says U.S. and Iranian diplomats met briefly last week on the sidelines of nuclear talks in Vienna. On the VOA program Issues in the News, moderator Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council spoke with her guests Hillary Krieger of the Washington Post and Jonathan Landay with McClatchy Newspapers. She began their conversation by asking about the success of the Iran nuclear talks.
A, do you think they're going to make it by the July 20 deadline? And B, it seems as though they've been able to keep Iraq out of these discussions. Are they going to be able to continue to do that?
Right. I think that as things unfold and the U.S. level of involvement becomes clear and how much the U.S. does try to work with Iran on this, I think that's going to be determined over the next few weeks as we get towards the July 20th deadline. I think it's unlikely there'll be a deal by that time. Yes, they seem to be making progress, but the issues that are outstanding are big ones. And of course, usually you're leaving the big ones till the end, and you count on the sort of the pressure of the clock ticking down to really get those gaps bridged. And there isn't that pressure. The agreement has a provision for another 6-month extension. While, both sides say they want this to get done, I don't think that there's sufficient urgency that you're really going to see the big, compromises that would need to take place to close the gaps in that short a time frame.
I'm going to differ with you there. I think that there is a lot of pressure to get it done because there's a concern in both countries that so-called hardliners will try to sabotage or hijack the process if they don't get a deal. Jonathan, Congress is chomping at the bit to try to pass, if not some new sanctions legislation, then resolutions that try to put Congress in the room with the negotiators. Also, this new crisis in Iraq is yet another financial drain on the Iranians, who have not gotten the sanctions relief that they had hoped for, even from the interim agreements. So what's your sense? Are they going to get there? And how does Iraq play with this nuclear issue?
Well, right now, the indications are that they have not been able to make much progress on the really thorny issues at stake here, the biggest one being the number of centrifuges, which are the machines that actually enrich uranium. The Iranians will be able to operate under the new agreement. They say they're not going to get rid of any. They want unlimited ability to operate centrifuges and maintain this secret site that will now not secret site anymore under a mountain outside of Qom, where they have centrifuges. The indications are, actually, that their unity has been maintained among the P5 plus one, the Europeans, on this issue, that they're not giving any ground. And I think that there is pressure on the Iranians. I think that Iraq has increased the pressure on the Iranians because they are stretched by the sanctions, but they're also stretched by the enormous role they're playing in Syria,
right,
which is not just in terms of providing manpower to advise and assist President Bashar Assad and his forces, which are stretched too. And I just got back from my second trip to Syria. But also the financial means that they're having to provide President Assad, which are crucial to him being able to maintain the sort of like this. He's created this sort of air of normalcy. It's a veneer of normalcy, but it's very important for him to be able to maintain the public support that he does maintain. And he does maintain a lot of public support still. And you've got the Iranians still having to support Hezbollah in Lebanon and Hezbollah operations inside of Syria. So they are under financial pressure, I think, to make this deal. But whether or not they're going to be able to compromise to the extent that the United States and its partners are looking for, that's the question.
Yeah. You mentioned the unity among the P5 plus one. The really crucial bits that emerged in the recent talks were that Russia and China are also telling the Iranians they have to cut the number of centrifuges.
Yeah,
that they simply cannot maintain the number. And when you consider that the Iranians have already won the principle that they can have an enrichment program, that's pretty big, that they got that concession under the interim agreement. So now we're in the souk, as they say, and it's a matter of, is it 10,000, is it 5,000, is it 3,000, what kind of centrifuge, and how long the restrictions will apply. So they convene again July the 2nd, and I would assume, Hillary, they're going to stay in the room until they get an agreement. Certainly give it a very good effort.
Barbara Slavin of the Atlantic Council and her guests, Hillary Krieger of the Washington Post, and Jonathan Landy with McClatchy Newspapers. You can hear their entire conversation on our website at voanews.com and look under the Programs tab for Issues in the News.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
A court in the United Arab Emirates has handed down sentences to seven men convicted of operating an al-Qaeda-linked terror cell within the country and channeling funds to militants fighting the Syrian government of Bashar al-Assad. Philip Walter Wellman has details from Dubai.
According to prosecutors, the group tried to recruit UAE citizens to the al-Nusra Front militant group in the hope they would provide additional financial backing for its cause. The defendants had also been accused of attempting to carry out bomb attacks in the Emirates and abroad. A Palestinian tried in absentia was given a life sentence for organizing the cell, while six other men, all of Arab origin, were given seven-year prison terms. Two others were acquitted of all charges. All of the men pleaded innocent, but the verdict by the federal Supreme Court is final and not subject to appeal. The case comes amid growing concerns among Gulf Cooperation Council countries over the rise of fundamentalist groups in the Middle East and the security risks they could pose at home. It's estimated that private Sunni donors from the Gulf have funneled hundreds of millions of dollars to militias and anti-Assad groups in Syria, including organizations like al-Nusra Front and the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, which is also capturing territory and battling security forces in Iraq. The director of the Geneva-based Gulf Research Center Foundation, Christian Koch, says the Gulf's rulers have condemned the unauthorized financing.
Certainly the GCC governments have made it very clear that they oppose any kind of funding going to these groups. There have been numerous measures put in place over the last decade about trying to control the kind of money that moves around. But of course, the state itself cannot control everything.
Dozens of Emiratis and Egyptians have been jailed in past months for links to the Muslim Brotherhood, a group outlawed in Egypt and many parts of the Gulf and accused of trying to overthrow regional monarchies. Lori Plotkin-Bogart, a Gulf specialist at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, points out that there have been several cases against Islamists who allegedly promoted violence in the UAE.
The UAE has been one of the most proactive Gulf states in fighting Islamist groups since the start of the Arab Spring, and the UAE views Islamist groups as its most menacing domestic threat.
Bogart and other analysts say the strengthening of ISIL in Syria and Iraq could lead to additional terrorism threats for the GCC. ISIL considers the Gulf's ruling families as illegitimate rulers of Muslims who should be replaced. Koch says militants see the regional bloc, particularly the UAE, as an attractive target for terrorist attacks.
It's a relatively open society that has 90% of its population being composed of foreigners, including a large amount of Westerners. So if attacks can be carried out in that country, it would certainly send a strong message about the potential instability of the GCC states. So I can see why they would target a country like the UAE, but I also know that the GCC states are fully aware of this.
Gulf nations have been spending increasing amounts to keep peace within their borders. The latest Global Peace Index shows the UAE spent $11.7 billion last year to prevent and contain violence, or about 4.3% of national GDP, while Saudi Arabia spent more than $87 billion. This is Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi says he will not interfere with judicial verdicts, a day after a Cairo court sentenced three Al Jazeera journalists to 7 years in prison on charges of supporting the banned Muslim Brotherhood and spreading false news. Mr. Sisi said today during a televised speech that rulings should be respected and not criticized. The sentences for Australian Peter Grest, Egyptian-Canadian Mohamed Fahmy, and Egyptian Bahar Mohamed drew harsh reactions from leaders and press freedom groups around the world. White House spokesperson Josh Earnest was asked at Monday's press briefing about U.S. reaction.
The prosecution of journalists for reporting information that does not coincide with the government of Egypt's narrative flouts the most basic standards of media freedom and represents a blow to democratic progress in Egypt. As we've said many times before, democracy is about more than elections. True democracy requires thriving democratic institutions, including a vibrant free press that is empowered to hold the government accountable to the people.
UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Navi Pillay says she is appalled by the verdicts. Her spokesman, Robert Colville, says she sees them as just the latest in a string of prosecutions and court cases that are in breach of international human rights law.
Probably the worst of all are these huge mass trials that took place earlier in the year of people who are allegedly Muslim Brotherhood supporters, but not just put on trial for being a supporter of an organization that is now deemed to be a terrorist organization, but actually condemned to death. And, and those court cases were really shocking. I mean, the High Commissioner today called them obscene, because there were hundreds of people, more than 500 in one case, 600 in another. There were such cursory cases, and then people were sentenced to death. So that's clearly, you know, an absolute travesty of justice.
In Canberra, Australian Foreign Minister Julie Bishop said the decision does not support Egypt's claim to be on a transition to democracy.
The Australian government urges the new government of Egypt to reflect on what message is being sent to the world about the situation in Egypt. Freedom and freedom of the press is fundamental to a democracy, and we are deeply concerned that this verdict is part of a broader attempt to muzzle the media freedom that upholds democracies around the world.
Al Jazeera's acting general director called the verdict shocking and said Al Jazeera will continue its international campaign to free its journalists.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
Cameroon's military has arrested 40 suspected Boko Haram militants in the north of the country. Moki Edwin Kazeka reports from Yaounde.
Cameroon State Radio broadcast that heavily armed soldiers stormed one of the largest markets in northern Cameroon, arrested suspected Boko Haram members, and seized an undisclosed quantity of equipment.
A gendarmerie raid on the Maroua Central Market has led to the arrest of over 40 people. The arrest is in connection with ongoing investigations into the activities of the Boko Haram Islamist group in the far north region of the country.
Maroua businessman Wanika Baba, in an interview with the private Danai FM radio station, says many of the arrested were his peers and there is confusion in the community.
Je comprends pas. On a fermé le marché depuis deux jours.
He says he does not understand what is happening as the military has had the market sealed for 2 days now and have arrested so many people. He says children and women are suffering from the closure and no one knows the fate of those arrested. Colonel Nyemek Pierre, who led the military raid, tells VOA that the central government ordered the military action as part of its fight against Boko Haram incursions into Cameroon.
Maintenant, c'est justement le rôle de la gendarmerie. Quand il y a flux de population, c'est la gendarmerie qui
sait. It is the duty of the military, he says, to filter the population so that enemies do not infiltrate into Cameroon. He adds that the matter is complicated because along the border, there are Nigerians and Cameroonians who belong to the same families, and soldiers have to try to distinguish who is a militant. This is the first time Cameroon's military has carried out an operation on such a large scale in a single day. Northern Cameroon has been plagued for almost a year with an influx of refugees and militants from strife in neighboring Central African Republic and the Boko Haram violence in northern Nigeria. Authorities in Cameroon have been urging citizens along the border, particularly with Nigeria's Borno State, the heart of the Boko Haram insurgency, to cooperate with the government by providing information on suspected sympathizers with the Islamist sect. The government here believes Boko Haram is now expanding its recruiting into Cameroon. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaounde.
The United States has welcomed the release of a Sudanese jail of a Christian woman sentenced to death by hanging for apostasy after refusing to convert to Islam under Sudan's Sharia law. VOA's Victor Beatty reports a U.S. lawmaker indicates Miriam Ibrahim, married to a Sudanese American, could soon be on her way to the United States.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry welcomed the decision by the Sudanese Court of Appeals Monday, ordering the 27-year-old mother of two released from prison, where she also faced a sentence of 100 lashes for adultery. Kerry says her case has rightly drawn the attention of the world and has been of deep concern to the U.S. government, its citizens, and lawmakers. Kerry said nothing can bring the lost moments back to a mother and her children, but, quote, today we celebrate the reunification of this family. Marie Harf is a U.S. State Department spokeswoman.
We also, at this point, continue to urge Sudan to repeal its laws that are inconsistent with its 2005 interim constitution, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. These actions would help demonstrate to the Sudanese people that their government intends to respect their fundamental freedoms and universal human rights. And as you know, this is a case we raised quite frequently with the government there. And welcome today's news.
U.S. Congressman Chris Smith, chairman of the House Africa Committee, applauded the release, saying Ibrahim's willingness to face martyrdom rather than recant is, quote, extraordinarily courageous and inspiring. Smith postponed a congressional hearing on the case due to begin today, calling her release a huge first step. The second, he said, is getting Ibrahim and her family on a plane to the United States. Smith said he expects the U.S. government to grant her and her children humanitarian parole to join her wheelchair-bound husband, Daniel Wani, who is already a naturalized U.S. citizen. Ibrahim was convicted of apostasy May 15th. She was born to a largely absent Muslim father and raised by her Ethiopian-born Christian mother. She was imprisoned with her 20-month-old son, Martin, since her arrest in December, and gave birth to a baby girl while incarcerated. Sudan's foreign ministry said the court decision came within the framework of the independence of the judiciary and in fulfillment of the provisions of the law, constitution, and the Bill of Fundamental Rights. It said the government came under unprecedented pressure from other governments, organizations, international figures, and the media. It also called for a review of U.S. sanctions imposed in 1997 that it says cause, quote, continued injustices against 35 million Sudanese people. The UK-based Christian Solidarity Worldwide organization says Ibrahim, her family, and defense attorneys face death threats from family members and extremists. CSW Chief Executive Mervyn Thomas called on Sudanese authorities to ensure her safety and that of her lawyers. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Thousands of people have fled their homes in northern Liberia following an invasion of caterpillars, which have overtaken houses and schools, destroyed crops, and contaminated water sources. Jennifer Lazuta reports.
More than a million caterpillars have invaded at least 25 villages and towns in the forested areas of Liberia's Lofa and Gaparopoulo counties. Residents have been fleeing en masse since early June to escape the trail of excrement that the caterpillars leave behind. Mary Tolbert lives in Gaparopoulo County.
We're afraid. You see, the caterpillars are all over, and there's nowhere to sleep. I'm living with my children to a different community.
Jeremiah Toe, a nurse in one of the affected villages, says the caterpillars pose a serious public health problem.
The situation is alarming. We have informed the Ministry of Health. As you can see, the caterpillars have taken over the home of the residents, have polluted the creeks. Even our clinic has been attacked by the caterpillar.
Residents and local authorities say the caterpillars have also taken over classrooms, forcing many schools in the area to shut down. Fresh water sources have become so contaminated with caterpillar feces that they are no longer safe to drink from. Farmers say some of their crops have been destroyed. This is not the first time caterpillars have attacked the region. A 2009 invasion caused the government to declare a state of emergency. Smaller invasions were seen in 2011 and 2012. Past attacks have been controlled through the spraying of pesticides. While the pesticides are said to be safe for both humans and crops, experts say there is a better way. Winfred Hammond is a senior entomologist at the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. He has helped with containment efforts on previous outbreaks.
The biggest concern is the fact that this is becoming a regular occurrence. It's about time that we seriously consider putting in place early warning systems.
Hammond says the caterpillars have not yet been identified, but are believed to come from a species of moth known as the Achaea catalcoloides, which is occasionally found in smaller numbers in Guinea, Benin, Ivory Coast, and a few other West and East African countries. Jennifer Lazuta for VOA News, Dakar.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On June 24th, 1497, explorer John Cabot, commissioned by England to find a northern route to Asia, sighted modern-day Newfoundland. He claimed the territory for King Henry VII. On this day in 1509, King Henry's son, Henry VIII, was crowned at the age of 17. He reigned during the Union of England and Wales and during his nation's split with the Roman Catholic Church. That split with Rome came when the church refused to annul the younger Henry's marriage to the first of his six wives. In 1821, the Battle of Carabobo was fought between South American independence fighters led by Simón Bolívar and loyalist troops. Bolívar's victory contributed to Venezuela's independence from Spain. In 1901, Spanish artist Pablo Picasso opened his first major exhibition at a gallery in Paris. Picasso was only 19 years old at the time, but had already produced a large body of work. In 1932, a bloodless coup ended Siam's monarchy, bringing 700 years of absolute rule in what is now Thailand to an end. In 1948, in the first major crisis of the East-West Cold War, the Soviet Union blocked rail and road access in and out of West Berlin. A huge airlift by the United States, Britain, and France kept the city supplied until the blockade was lifted the next year. In 1970, the U.S. Senate voted to repeal the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin Resolution that had become the legal basis for every presidential action taken by the Johnson administration during its conduct of the Vietnam War. That's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Vital Voices, a U.S.-based international non-governmental organization that trains and mentors women leaders around the world in the areas of political participation, economic development, and human rights, recently awarded its Global Trailblazer Award to Syrian human rights defender Razan Zeytuneh. Her sister Rana accepted the award on her behalf at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. Ms. Zeytuneh is a 37-year-old lawyer who represented Syrian political prisoners across sectarian lines for years. In 2007, she created Syria's first human rights information bank to document violations and publish them to the world. A supporter of peaceful democratic reform and nonviolent civil resistance, she elected to stay in Syria and continue her work in 2011, even after fighting erupted and the regime officially denounced her. Razan Zeytuneh detailed the abuses and the atrocities occurring in Syria and also founded the Violations Documentation Center. In December 2013, Ms. Zeytuneh was abducted, along with her husband and two colleagues, reportedly from the office of the Violations Documentation Center in Douma, near Damascus. Her whereabouts remain unknown, and no individual or group has claimed responsibility for her disappearance. During a speech in London at the Global Summit to End Sexual Violence in Conflict, Secretary of State John Kerry spoke of Razan Zeytuneh.
Razan has risked her life inside Syria to care for political prisoners and call attention to human rights violations, including against women. We stand in awe of her leadership and heroism.
Secretary of State Kerry once again called for the release of Razan Zeytuneh, as well as the release of thousands of detained and disappeared human rights defenders in Syria and around the globe. We need to stand up and stand by them, said Mr. Kerry. Their voices must not be silenced.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage. www.voanews.com/editorials.